Let's face it, people have different sleep needs. While you love your partner, sleeping next to them might not always be the most comfortable. Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs, so you can choose what's right for each of you whenever you like. Maybe you prefer a firmer mattress and your partner needs something softer. Because of the individualized comfort that you get from Sleep Number Smart Beds, you and your partner will sleep better together. All Sleep Number Smart Beds feature cooling, pressure-relieving comfort layers for soothing sleep throughout the night. And their temperature balancing bedding is designed to move heat and moisture away when you're hot. When you're cool, they hold their energy to help warm you. The smart beds even automatically respond and adjust to your movements, so you sleep comfortably all night long. JD Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For JD Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com. /awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
The following podcast is a Dear Media production.
Hey guys, welcome to Breaking Beauty,
the podcast all about the best-selling beauty products and the damn good stories behind them. We're your hosts, Carlene Higgins
and Jill Dunn.
Hey everyone, welcome back to Breaking Beauty Podcast.
Hey Jill.
Hey Carlene.
What's up?
Well, this is a very special edition for us. It's a little bit of a throwback episode.
It is, and that's because we're on vacation.
Yeah.
And we hope that you're on vacation too, quite honestly, listening in a car on a road trip somewhere.
Yay. So let's tell everybody what we're up to.
So we are revisiting an oldie but a goodie. It is the story of how MAC Cosmetics came to be with co-founder Frank Toskin.
So what better time to revisit this? Not only is it Pride Month, but MAC, the brand, has been around for 35 years this year. Mm-hmm. Viva Glam Lipstick, their philanthropic initiative, is celebrating 25 years this year.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the 50th anniversary of the Stonewall riots, right?
Yeah, everything's just converging at once.
Yeah.
So before you get listening, we're going to talk all about Viva Glam and the history and all the great stuff it's done for the HIV AIDS community. But before we get to that, we want to deliver a quick update, because last year when we launched this episode, it was around Canada Day, we mentioned an academic book. So if you like to nerd out on beauty history, the book that was being written was called Viva MAC AIDS: Fashion and the Philanthropic Practices of MAC Cosmetics, written by Andrea Benoit and illustrated by Donald Robertson, famous illustrator, and it finally launched this month.
Yay. And we have a chat with Andrea in this episode, so you will hear from her. But at the time, the book cover was so under wraps. So
yeah,
it's amazing.
It was a work in progress.
Yeah.
And now it's for sale. Mm-hmm. You can buy the book at Barnes & Noble. You can also find it at Amazon.
Mm-hmm.
We originally produced this episode in two parts because the story is so epic.
Yeah. But a lot of you had given feedback that you wanted the episode on one long track so you can enjoy it all at once. So we deliver.
Yeah. Go ahead, download it, take it on your road trip, and happy Canada Day.
Yeah. Happy Pride, everyone. Happy listening too. Hello, everybody. Welcome back to Breaking Beauty. This is Jill here.
This is Carlene.
So Canada Day is just upon us. And, you know, we've talked a lot on this show, Carlene, about some hot Canadian beauty brands.
Yeah, we've talked about Nude Sticks, Dessie M, Sage, The Seven Virtues.
Yeah, these have all been guests. These people, these brands have all been guests on our show. But I think we can both agree there's only one Canadian household name in the beauty biz.
Yeah, that even like my grandmother, if you were still here would know the name of, and that is MAC Cosmetics.
Yeah.
Yeah. So this was like a career making moment for Jill and I.
Yes.
To be able to sit down with Frank Toskin, co-founder of the original MAC Cosmetics, was just like dream come true.
Incredible. This is his first interview in 4 years. Mm-hmm. He is very much under the radar, does his own thing. He doesn't grant interviews a lot. Reason being, he's not involved in MAC Cosmetics in the day-to-day any longer. He sold the business to Estee Lauder. He and his co-founding partner, Frank Angelo, who has sadly since passed away, they sold MAC to Estee Lauder in what year was it?
1998.
Yeah. So
Jill had to do some serious sleuthing.
I did what I do, which is just creep on the internet until I find something that I can use.
Until she finds a way.
Yes.
I love that about you.
But the thing was, we knew we could do this because he's right here in our backyard.
Yeah.
Let's set the scene where we were.
Yeah. So he actually lives in Toronto, and we sat down in his actual real life living room in a condo in Yorkville. We won't tell you more than that. We don't want, you know, super fans showing up at his door. But yeah, we were sitting on the sofa. His two dogs were there.
Yeah.
It was so intimate and
very
lovely.
Relaxed.
He is so warm.
Yeah.
Loved hanging out with him. We have photo evidence, and it looks like we've just woken up on Christmas morning. It's hilarious. We look like a family.
We're all like, gathered around the mic with the cup with the dogs.
Yeah.
And only thing that's missing is like the Russian red lipstick and the and like the strobe cream.
They weren't too far away.
Let's start with a little bit of beauty school knowledge.
Yeah.
If people do not know, MAC was founded in 1984, and it stands for Makeup Art Cosmetics.
Its tagline is all ages, all races, all sexes. That was the original. It's now updated to be all races, all ages, all genders. So when you think about the fact that they launched with that in 1984, how progressive that truly was. I mean, that could be a tagline for a makeup brand launching today.
Yeah.
And I'm sure internally that is so many brands' ethos, but they really are standing on the shoulders of a giant, which is MAC Cosmetics, who broke down barriers at retail level in people's minds.
Yeah. They paved the way. There would be no Too Faced, probably no Fenty Beauty. MAC just came in and was like, We're just doing us. We're just going to have cross-dressers at our counter. We're going to have makeup in pots.
Yeah.
Who's using those stupid sponges? We don't need those. Yeah. Like, they just were like rebellious.
And coming out with like millions of colors that people thought nobody would ever buy. Because it was all about self-expression. Not products you needed.
Yes.
But products that you wanted.
Yeah.
To be able to express who you truly were inside. And then you talk about cruelty-free. You talk about recycling.
Back to MAC.
I mean, so incredibly progressive. And you've got to give credit where credit's due.
And like a tribe, an army of people. You knew the, you know, I remember one of Linda Wells' editor letters, one of my favorite ones she ever wrote at Allure, was talking about taking a trip to Toronto and seeing tribes of people dressed head to toe in black going to like a MAC conference. You know, you wanted to be part of that.
Yeah.
And it wasn't try hard. It was inclusive.
Yeah. I remember myself in the early 90s, let's say, like playing with makeup, and there was no way that I was going to go out and buy any other brand.
No.
At the time, it was the only one that a young, cool person would use.
Yeah.
And I was obsessed with Twig lipstick.
It was
like a brownie, mauve-y shade that, I mean, everybody wore it. And Spice lip liner, everybody wore it.
Yeah. And you're talking about, you know, super, super models of that day and that era to everyone. This was like when we were in high school, right? This is like the heyday or junior high or whatever.
Yeah.
But you know, MAC is it's still leading the charge. It's still like the number one prestige brand, even though it's been sold, you know, it's in Estee Lauder's hands now.
Yeah.
The parent company. A MAC lipstick is sold every second around the world.
Yeah.
And it's best known for my favorite iconic shades like Ruby Woo. Remember even when Rihanna came out with her collection for MAC long before Fenty Beauty, she did Woo.
Yeah, her own spin on it.
Yeah, and it was so great. It's like that bluish red. Mm-hmm. It's the bestseller. There's 4 tubes sold every minute of Ruby Woo around the world. It's crazy.
Yeah.
Let's talk about philanthropy.
And so in 1994, Viva Glam was born.
Yes.
They launched their very first special edition lipstick. It was a deep red, and it was completely unprecedented because 100% of the sales every penny went back to the MAC AIDS fund.
Yeah. And this isn't profits. This isn't proceeds. It's literally every dollar. Nobody took a commission. You're going to hear all about that later. But it's just so groundbreaking and celebrating 25 years.
Yeah.
So amazing. How much did they raise again? So
$480 million have gone to this cause. They have had, you know, top-notch celebrities that have come on board. RuPaul was the very first.
So great.
Love RuPaul and the perfect face. And again, Frank is going to tell us how that came together in the beginning. Katie Lang was another one. Doesn't even wear makeup.
No, a queer woman who doesn't wear makeup. Yeah. Like it, back in the day when all the models were like Nikki Taylor.
Yeah.
And who else was like fronting beauty campaigns back then?
Cindy Crawford.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. These fresh faced all-American girls wearing the glowy makeup. Yeah. And he's just like, no.
I mean, a brand with soul is what they were.
Exactly.
Like so much soul.
Yeah.
And it really does continue to today. And I think that is just so fantastic to see. Nicki Minaj has done Viva Glam, Miley Cyrus. MAC is sold in over 100 countries now. And starting this fall, they will actually enter Sephora.ca here in Canada. Yes. Can't say the same for the US, but you guys have Ulta. So that's going to be just one other place where we can find MAC. So that's a milestone.
Big that's huge. Them. That is absolutely huge. We're going to hear so much from Frank, but we just want to make a note that we got a bit of a scoop while we were there because I was bugging him to make a Netflix documentary about MAC. And he said that actually somebody has recently written a book. It's called Viva MAC, AIDS, Toronto Fashion, and the Philanthropic Practices of MAC Cosmetics. It's written by Andrea Benoit, and it comes out in 2019, published by the University of Toronto. And stay tuned. We actually get the author herself on the phone to learn more about the project and the book.
Again, MAC's Canadian roots, they do remain strong. Many of the best sellers are still manufactured right here in Markham, Ontario, just outside of Toronto. The MAC lipstick, the MAC lip glass, another like fan favorite.
Did I ever tell you when I went to Markham?
No.
And I was there, it honestly wasn't that long ago.
Lucky
I think it
girl.
Was like 2012 I was there.
Okay.
And I had the lab coat on and I was making my own lip glass. And I remember this like defining moment where you added the fragrance into your lip glass color, and it just brought you right back because it's that vanilla smell. That's something else that really made them stand out.
Yeah.
That smell went into all their lipsticks and to the lip glass, which just created a whole other category.
Yeah. Just another example of how they broke ground, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So
do you guys have your Russian Red out right now? Put it on. Get your strobe cream.
Get your furry slippers out.
Your blot powder. You know, and we haven't even touched on how MAC created all the trends around the world basically for the last several decades.
Oh, and what about, you guys have to listen to the end because Frank is going to tell us all about his next indie startup project, which is, I'm a big fan of this brand and the products already, and it will be touching down to South Beach starting in about a year. So I'm not going to give away any more than that. You're going to have to listen to part two.
Yeah.
We begin with Frank as a young child, a dreamer in every sense of the word.
I'm Frank Toskin, and I'm the co-founder of MAC Cosmetics. I was born in a small town in what is now Slovenia, which used to be former Italy, which used to be former Yugoslavia. So that's where I was kind of sequestered for the first 6 years of my life with my grandparents, because my parents were refugees at that time, and my mom was in Italy. My father was sort of trying to get out of Yugoslavia. So I grew up with my grandparents. My grandmother was a dressmaker, so I sat beside her for endless hours, and that's, I think, where my interest in fashion and design came from. Sitting beside her, I started using the little pedal sewing machine, and that's kind of like where I got, I think, a lot of my interest from my grandmother. Very soon after that, my parents decided to come to Canada. So my grandparents took me with my little suitcase, because that's all you were allowed to leave with in a communist country at that time. And they took me to the border, reunited me with my parents on the other side, and we spent a year in a refugee camp near Trieste, and my parents finally got an okay and approval to come to Canada. So we landed in Halifax in 58. It was like this probably old ship that we came on, and everybody was vomiting because the seas were rough. And we landed in Halifax in, I think it was around the end of March, and it was gray and dark and cold. And we had just come from this sunny, bright, beautiful place in northern Italy. And it was kind of depressing. And we were put on a train, shipped out west to Calgary. My parents were put to work on a sugar beets farm. And their bubble was kind of burst at that time because they came here for the better life. So here they found themselves farming from morning to sunset, and it wasn't what they expected. It was a hardship for them. At that time, they had to pay for their way over, so they had to work it off, their fare over here. And luckily, we came to they decided to come to Toronto, and they decided to go back to Italy. But we passed through Toronto, and they met some friends here, and we ended up staying here. So that's kind of like how we got here.
What does a five-year-old pack on a journey to a whole new world?
Well, I took a little toy that I still have, and it was a little push toy that you push with your finger from the bottom, and it was two people dancing around, and it was a little wooden toy, and I still have that. A little suit that was made by my grandmother. I didn't keep that, unfortunately, and I didn't keep that suitcase. I think the only thing I kept was a little toy. I'm glad that my parents did come here. I do feel displaced sometimes, though, because, you know, I still have my first language was, first of all, it was Slovenian, and then it was Italian. And that's where I went to school for the first year of my life. It was a little odd for a young child to be thrown into grade one and try and understand how this system works. I remember a particular incident where the teacher was calling me by my name, and she was calling me Franco, and I would say, no, mi chiamo Franco, not Franco. So I stopped responding to her, and I'm sure she hated me because I just would not answer to Franco. It taught my parents and myself, you know, how to fit in and how to adapt, and, you know, taught us a lot about hard work and the struggles that people have to go through. You know, we weren't privileged. My parents weren't privileged. They were also displaced. And, you know, we bonded together as a family, a unit. And that was invaluable for us, for the support that I later counted on my parents for, because they were there for me and I was there for them.
A person's first job is often seemingly random, but sometimes when you look back, you realize it was those small, invaluable lessons that can last a lifetime, as was the case with Frank.
My first job was making Christmas trees. I worked for Noma Manufacturing. They made Christmas trees and Christmas lights. And that was my first job. I had to lie about my age because I had to be 16 to work in the factory. I was 14. But in those days, nobody really questioned you or asked you for your passport or any kind of, certificate to prove that you were 16. So I ended up getting that job, and I loved it. For the time, it gave me the money that I needed, and gave me the opportunity to buy my first car as soon as I turned 16. So there was freedom in working. My car was a Corvair Monza. I know. What is that? It was it's an old car, a little sports car with a rusted floor. I remember I could see the street as I was driving, but I think it was probably about $250. Anyway, it did the trick. It got me from the suburbs to downtown Toronto. So that's all I needed. And nothing ever meant as much to me in my life again. I was able to get a Mercedes, and I was able to get, better cars, but nothing gave me the excitement and the pleasure that cheap little rusted out Corvair Monza did.
Now we come to the next chapter, how the co-founders of Mac, Frank Toscan, and the late Frank Angelo, also known as the Two Franks, met.
I met Frank when I was around 21 at a dance club called the Manatee here. And I remember that we only had a couple of dance clubs as gay youth at that time in Toronto. And so we'd all hang out as a community in these two or three clubs that we had. And I remember I'd always catch a glimpse of Frank staring at me from far away the other side of the room. And one day I managed to, you know, get the nerve to go up to him and say, you know, what the hell are you looking at? You're starting to drive me crazy and bug me. And he said, I'm looking at you because I like you. And I said, oh, okay. And that was it. You know, it was that was the start of our relationship, you know, got to know each other, and we really liked each other. That was kind of like it. The world is a better place for having had someone like Frank Angelo here. He was back as a child. I know that he was a very precocious child. He started carving out his own career, I think, by the age of 9 or 10. He put a band together at the age of 12, and by the age of 14, he was recording, and by the age of 15, he was already traveling North America and performing. So he came to Toronto back in the 60s and met Blair James, who was a talented hairdresser at that time. And they started a place called The Haircutting Place, and it was the first ever of its kind. They did unisex haircutting, just at the time when the hippies with long hair were cutting their hair, and they didn't want to go to formal salons. I kind of like, you know, hung around and watched what everybody was doing, and I realized there was an opportunity there to step in and create a job and a role for myself. And I started doing photography. I knew he was buying like all these posters of haircuts, because that's what the Haircutting Place was known for all of these haircuts that they developed. And every month they'd come out with new haircuts. I looked at these posters and I thought, well, I think I can do better than that. I went to hair school and I started learning how to cut hair, and I started learning how to, you know, take photographs. And so I started producing some of these posters, which I started selling in other hair salons as well. Tacky posters at that time, but still interesting. It gave me a start, and it gave me an insight into makeup and how light works with film. And so I learned a lot out of that that from that time. My stint at school was very short, because I went to Bruno's, and one day, you know, we would bring in, people came in off the street, it was, and we did their hair for free. So one day this very, this lady came in, and she wasn't really a nice person. Anyway, I was given her as a client, and this is how we practice. And I put her in the shampoo chair, and I forgot to put the cape behind the chair, so I shampooed her hair and without the cape being behind the chair, so all the water ran down onto the seat, and she was soaking wet when she got up, and she screamed at me, and she lost it in the store, and the teacher started siding with her, and it was an honest mistake. That didn't go well, and I walked out. So I never really got to finish hair school, but I got to know enough about it. So I didn't get to create great hairstyles. I was more an updo guy. I used to love doing updos and roller sets and pin curls, 9 o'clock pin curls, 3 o'clock pin curls, and updos. That's what it was all about at that time.
If you walk by a MAC counter today, you'd never imagine that those bright and bold pots of eyeshadows, fluorescent lipsticks, and glittery glitters were born in Frank Toscan's kitchen. But that's exactly how the story goes.
When I started doing makeup, there wasn't really a lot on the market. You know, there was very limited product. I mean, most things were sold, eyeshadows were sold in little palette compacts of three colors, light, medium, and dark. And you know, it was like a paint by numbers approach that most cosmetic companies took. If you had red hair, you'd wear green eyeshadow with yellow tones. And if you had blonde hair, you could wear blues. I found it very restricting. And I started going to Curry's, and I started going to stores and starting to mix my own blend of colors. And I started to take brushes, because there weren't brushes on the market at that time. Most people use sponge tip applicators, or they use their fingers. That's the way makeup was typically applied back then, you know, and I couldn't find brushes, so I would go to like the art stores and find brushes that worked for me. Every type of product works better with a different type of a specific brush. Whether it's if it's a wet product, it'll work better with a synthetic. If it's a dry product, it'll work better with a natural hairbrush. So, you know, I developed my own brushes and then sent them off and had them duplicated, and they were a hit. Nobody was doing it at the time, really. It was you're younger than me, but I know my mother only used her fingers or this little sponge tip applicator that came into compacts at the time. I think they've done away with most of those things now because the industry has realized there's money to be made in brushes. And I think we also changed the face of makeup in terms of education. You know, when we launched MAC, it was about teaching people how to use products correctly and with the right tools, and that had never been done before. It was more cosmetic companies tend to sell product, and that was the end of it. We brought people in, taught people how to use makeup and the tools that were right for what they wanted to achieve, and then they were your customers for life because you just helped them learn and be discriminating about the products that they bought.
MAC 1.0 quickly outgrew the kitchen sink, and as the word was getting out in the makeup artist community, the demand started to grow to the point where they opened their very first standalone pro store.
Our first pro store was on Parliament and Carleton. Not a great area, and people wonder why we opened there, but the building was cheap, and Frank and I lived on the top floor. We had our office on the second floor. We had a beauty salon called MAC Hair on the main floor, and downstairs I did my makeup. In kind of private, and at that time it was I just really made and developed products for professionals, very raw products, like things like pigments and things that makeup artists could use themselves and mix with mediums that they wanted to. And that just grew. I mean, the demand just grew. It was by appointment only when I was on my own there, and then all of a sudden we started packaging the products, and it just evolved.
How do homemade cosmetics go to the next level? We've said it before on Breaking Beauty Podcast, and we'll say it again. It's always good to know a chemist.
My sister was dating a chemist at the time, and I thought that, I brought him in and said, Vic, I've got a challenge here for you. Do you think we can work on some products together? Vic had never made makeup before, so, we went to the library, got some books, and we learned how to mix some products. I knew what I wanted, and he gave me the opportunity to actually see it to fruition. So then all of a sudden I was able to create products that had never been made before. And, people really embraced all this new creative opportunity that they had with makeup. I always loved makeup for the fact that it was playful, and I always felt it wasn't necessary to wear makeup. It was something that people did and used as an accessory to have fun with, but never did I sell products because I ever told anyone that they needed a product to make them look better. So we always took a very different approach in the way we sold our products. There was Frank, and then there was Vic, and then there was my sister, and then there was Rod Ulmer at the Bay, who embraced who we were and allowed us to come into the department store. And we didn't fit into the cosmetic department, but he wanted to give us a chance. We were young and hungry and eager, and he thought we had something to offer, and he recognized that, and so he said, I'll give you a space on the second floor back in the corner, and we'll see how you do there. And, I worked there. We had another two males working in there, and that was unheard of in those days to have guys working at the makeup department. We'd get our curious clients in, we'd do their makeup, they'd go back to the office, and all of a sudden the next day, like, there were 10 other women that came in saying, wow, you did this for my friend yesterday, can you do this for me? And that just grew. It just grew and grew from that word of mouth. There's a lot of pressure in the cosmetic department to perform like everyone else, and it's very competitive, and you sell, generally because of commission and pressure from the different brands to compete. So we didn't have that to worry about. We just worried about how to do what we did well.
It's 1985, and MAC decides it needs to go to the heart of the action. So it opens its first standalone store for consumers in New York City.
Of Christopher and Gay Street was the corner we opened on. Most people thought we were crazy for going down in Greenwich Village. They said, you know, this is not where you start, right? But we knew that there was a vibe there, and there was a creative energy in that area. It's where all the drag queens lived. It's where kind of like the underground scene was percolating at the time, and there was so much change and excitement in that area. You know, the other areas of New York were really established. So that's kind of what fit our personality at the time. And, you know, it was a very exciting time. We had, you know, celebrities started coming in. We had, we hired drag queens like Lady Bunny and Lady Miss Guy. RuPaul was in the store. Lady Miss Keir would come in. I think even Lady Gaga would be at the window peeking in because she was too young at the time. I heard a story of that. She would come down to the store and just look at all the drag queens and wish she was old enough to come in and wear the makeup and just participate. So we had, there was a real energy and a vibe. Within a year, we had busloads of people coming down from uptown and because we became kind of like the show on Saturdays and Sundays. And it was an exciting time. None of what we did was really calculated. It all just evolved and developed from who we were as people. And all the thoughts and all the ideas came from all different aspects of life. And, you know, for all races, all sexes, first of all, I couldn't understand why, you know, there wasn't a lot of makeup for women of color. I never understood that because I had lots of friends of color. So, and you know, there was so much diversity, especially in New York. And so we developed colors, and that was part of our success as well. We developed colors that really, you know, worked on all people. We had like 35 foundation colors from blue-black skins to the palest of porcelain skins. And all gamuts from cools, green undertones, yellow undertones, red undertones. And we sort of covered everybody's, you know, skin tone in our range of foundations.
We've talked a lot about the trend toward 40 foundation shades on the podcast recently. Of course, when we say trend, we don't mean trendy. We just mean what's happening in the industry right now. But MAC was really leading in this category toward inclusive skin tone shades from the very beginning. Curiously, though, MAC's strategy wasn't as much about the quantity of shades available. It was more about giving people the tools to make their own match.
So we were early on, we were doing it we didn't have the ability to package that many skin tones. So we were doing it by selling pigment, and people were able to mix their own pigments, which really, it allowed them to participate in making their own products as well to some degree. And that was kind of interesting. We would sell like yellow pigment or blue pigment or red pigment, so you could mix it into your foundation and alter it, because you don't need that many different products. I mean, you could take a skin cream and mix it into your foundation. You could stretch your foundation by mixing it into, you know, like a different medium. So we always tried to limit the number of products we had by utilizing, you know, different mediums. Cover FX is a line that I started with my brother-in-law after we sold MAC. And it's in the market today, and it has incredible foundation shades, and also offers the same type of philosophy. Like, you can buy a shiny pigment and use it in your foundation. You can use it in your skin cream. You can use it dry. You can use it wet. You can use it, you know, in so many ways.
Their hiring practices were certainly unconventional at the time, and that was all part of the magic.
Well, you know, I hired like people, and we never discriminated, because artists are generally creative, and you can't put them in a white lab coat and tell them what to say and what to wear. And we gave them an incredible amount of freedom to be who they were. And that, you know, empowered us, because they became very loyal people who loved what they did because they were allowed to do what they love. And that created an electricity and an energy at the counter. And, you know, our staff was never boring. They were allowed to have piercings, and they were allowed to cross-dress. There was freedom there. And that freedom just created this electricity at the counter and this show that just went on, and that always, you know, attracted a lot of attention from all kinds of people.
But controversy struck when Mac started handing out free condoms at counters at the height of the AIDS epidemic.
That was the conflict, you know, like we were growing and we needed to grow because our product was in the demand, but yet we were growing sometimes with people that didn't necessarily believe in everything that we stood for. Luckily, we had developed a strength in money and money talk sometimes to retailers. We used that platform to say, hey, we're here, you don't like us, we're out. And, you know, it didn't always go over well handing out condoms, particularly in, you know, the 80s. But, hey, that's what was needed and that's what we did. And that's what I think set us apart from everyone else. And that was an incredible opportunity to use what we had created to do good.
People still face discrimination today, let's be real, but I think we can agree that we are in a better place today than we were 20 odd years ago. And a big part of that is thanks to people and brands who took a stand for equality in the workplace.
We actually really got off on doing that kind of stuff because we were always the underdog, and any opportunity to stand up, we celebrated. There was an incident in one of the department stores in San Francisco, and one of our employees was let go because he was a cross-dresser, and beautiful cross-dresser. I mean, very few people actually knew, and he was a great salesperson, a great artist, and he was a real asset to our company. And he was let go because some customers found him offensive, I guess. And luckily he was the friend of Linda Ronstadt at that time, who was a singer. I don't know if you remember, but she took a great offense to it, and good for her. They picketed the store the next day, and they were forced to hire back that employee, and they rewrote their policy on what was acceptable and not acceptable in their store. So, you know, that was a situation that really changed attitudes in the department store.
Remember earlier when Frank mentioned that unbreakable bond that is your family? Here's an example of the lengths that his loved ones would go to support his dream.
I had the fortune to have people in my life who cared for me and who wanted to see me succeed. And, you know, people like Frank Angelo, people like my parents who mortgaged their house for me to, you know, move on with my business at times where it was sometimes uncertain. And but again, you know, we were a team and we were there for each other, and that became our strength. And I tell you, having family is amazing, because at the end of the day, if it's payday and you don't have the money, they'll still be there on Monday and Saturday and Sunday. So having that kind of support was very important for the success of that brand.
Every successful beauty brand can be traced back to a defining moment. We've covered many of them right here on Breaking Beauty Podcast, when the bestseller became a bestseller. For MAC, like many others, it was a combination of star power meeting print power. Magazines, remember those? None of this was paid for, by the way.
I didn't believe in advertising, and that was something that we were very strict about from the beginning. I didn't believe, you know, that telling people they needed your product was the way to go. I believed in creating a need for the product. It was a pivotal moment, and that was probably the time that I opened a magazine, and there we were. I think it was a 4-page spread in People magazine, which was a big magazine at the time. It was probably one of the largest circulations. And there was Madonna and Lady Di and Naomi Campbell and Linda Evangelista all talking about MAC. The next day, I guess after reading that article, we had calls from every major department store and retailer in North America and Europe wanting to carry our product. They were all talking about MAC and how wonderful, you know, it was to have discovered this product that worked for them, and to discover this company that stood for so much more than just makeup. You know, we had many initiatives at that time. We had Back to MAC. We had Cruelty for Your Beauty, and, you know, we had Viva Glam. We had many initiatives that people embraced. So people didn't come to us just to buy a lipstick. They came to us, even if they weren't wearing lipstick, they'd come to support, like the Viva Glam program. Many women would come in just to buy it for their friends, even if they weren't wearing makeup. So there were so many reasons people liked associating themselves with us, because they felt that they were helping others as well.
Let's talk about one of the most iconic MAC lipsticks of all time, Russian Red.
The first shade I ever created was called 100% Red. And then one day I got a call from Madonna's makeup artist, Debbie Mazur, and she said, I'm working on Madonna's tour. And she said, we need to create some products. And she said, I'd like a really strong lipstick, like this lipstick that was 100% red, but I want it to be really, really matte. So I created this lipstick called Russian Red. And I think she wore it on her album cover, and it became sort of like the signature color on her Blonde Ambition tour. And it was like this really, if you remember Madonna back in the 80s, it was all about her red lips. And she certainly put us on the map with that color.
So many trends come from marketing teams these days. It's almost hard to remember the days when trends and color inspiration actually came from the creativity and energy of an artist.
My inspiration was the runway and my friends. You know, I had friends that were in the industry. I had friends that were models. I had friends that were designers. I had friends that were artists. And I was fortunate enough that, you know, I had an inside kind of look to what was going on. And fashion, you know, what we wear on our bodies kind of dictates what makeup trends will kind of be a complement that. And so I knew beforehand what was going to be coming out the year after. And, you know, so I had kind of a head start. I wasn't in a boardroom deciding, you know, what campaign are we going to, like, put out there to sell this product that we've just created. We don't know if it's going to sell. We don't know if it's even going to take off. I knew that we were creating our own demand. So I was very fortunate that I had that, you know, that I was at the bottom.
Up next, the incredible inspiration behind MAC's legendary Viva Glam lipstick.
The proudest accomplishments, I think. And I'm proud for the company to have, you know, continued that initiative. Back in the 80s, it was a very sad and dark time. And my very close friend was dying of AIDS. I was called into the hospital. They told me to put on a robe and a mask and gloves. And, you know, I went in. And I was told to keep my distance, and I realized, you know, how horrible that must have been for him to be looking at these people, looking at him like a leper. And that ignited something in me, you know, an anger that I took with me, and it came to visit me later on, but I knew that someday that moment would inspire me to do something with that. Because it was a very sad time. It was a very dark time for our community here in all over the world. It was a very dark time. And so, you know, his passing didn't go in vain. So I kind of attribute this success to John Lazoric, and very grateful that I had that I did something with that opportunity that I was offered. It was like a gift from John to say, you know what, I may not have the ability to do anything now, but Frank, take it forward and do something with it. That was such a horrible time in our lives, because we were all, as a community, really saddened by where we were put. We were being put away, and you know, we lost a lot of people. I never wanted this to look like a marketing scheme, you know, so we made sure that every penny went back to, you know, what it was raised, intended for. We demanded that our retail partners didn't take a makeup. Our sales staff never took any commissions on this product. And so we sold it right through. 100% of every MAC Viva Glam lipstick that's sold goes directly to the MAC AIDS Fund. And I'm very proud of that.
Hello.
Hi, it's Jill.
And this
Hi,
is Carleen.
Hi, how are you?
Good, how are you?
Good, thank you.
Maybe we can just start with your name and your profession.
Sure. So my name is Andrea Benoit, and I am an academic. I have worked for the last few years as an adjunct assistant professor in the Faculty of Information and Media Studies at Western University. And right now I work at the University of Toronto in an academic administrative role.
Great.
The book is coming out hopefully next spring, but it will be 2019, and it's called Viva MAC, AIDS, Toronto Fashion, and the Philanthropic Practices of MAC Cosmetics.
And so with a thesis, you know, typically you have an idea and you prove it and then you come to a conclusion.
Mm-hmm.
What conclusion did you come to in terms of the significance of MAC Viva Glam and the whole campaign?
It sounds kind of, I don't want to say a cop-out, but it sounds like to me it was something that could not be reproduced. It was a particular set of people and a particular convergence of events. You had the revitalization of the Toronto fashion industry and the cultural industries in general in the 80s. You had that happening. You had the AIDS epidemic happening and the particular ways that activist networks were responding to AIDS in Toronto in the 1980s. And then you had the emerging pattern of the commodification of social causes starting in the late 80s and working into the 90s, that everything kind of converged, and it was the right people in the right place at the right time with the right energy. And I determined that, you know, perhaps one of the reasons nobody has written much about this is that it can't be used as a model for how to do good branding or how to make a really great ad. You know, it was something that arose so organically and authentically with the right set of circumstances at that moment that it stands alone. There's really nothing else that could compare to the way that the Franks developed their business and made their contribution to AIDS and AIDS fundraising and AIDS advocacy at that particular moment in time.
Who could possibly embody such an important initiative and keep that playful, positive Mac spirit alive?
Sashay Shantae. Sashay Shantae. Turn to the left. Now turn to the right. You see these jewels? They are paid for. Are you ready for this, Sashay Shantae? All right. I thought so.
I have one thing to say. You better work, bitch.
Right? Would it be Elizabeth Taylor? Would it be who would it be? Would she be young? Would she be black? I could never put my finger on it. I never. It was so abstract to me because I never thought one person could represent all of what Mac was. And one year I was in Wigstock in New York, and my friend Donald Robertson, who had moved to New York, I don't know if you're a very successful artist, his wife Kim worked for us, and so he took me to Wigstock, and RuPaul was performing. And, you know, we both looked at each other and thought, wow, like this is it, because we had talked about a face. And this is it. He lived the community. He was touched by all of the same things that we were touched by. He fought for the same things that we were fighting for. And he was all about makeup. I mean, God, he wore more makeup than anybody else that I had seen. He kind of had fun with it. It wasn't so serious, you know. It was what about makeup can do. Not that it was corrective. It was also like, here it is. Here's your paint. Paint up your face to which, however you know, whatever way pleases you, and have fun with it. I'd have loved to have gotten a Vogue cover with him. We tried to pitch for that, but I think it was too early on, maybe today. It wasn't about money. It was about him, you know, jumping on this bandwagon that we were on and making a difference and becoming part of this team of mavericks that was going to change not only the cosmetic industry, but change how people saw the community, you know, what AIDS was doing to us. And we were on the same page.
Mac wasn't just breaking down barriers when it came to race and gender. They were also leading the charge when it came to mindful consumption.
One of the things that I resented was overpackaging, and the cosmetic industry was very guilty of overpackaging, especially in the 80s. And it's something that I always was very offended by. So we stripped it down to bare minimal. You know, we created the single pots, which up till then were rarely seen. People bought them in trios. Recycling was very important. So we took back every five containers with that initiative. We gave people a free lipstick. So they, you know, they didn't change the garbage of the world, but they certainly got to thinking about it. And I think, you know, that's what it was all about, getting people thinking, getting them involved, getting them going, igniting some thought around, you know, the crises that are about to take over this world.
In 1994, the two Franks sold a 51% stake in MAC to Estee Lauder. In 1997, Frank Angelo passed away of a cardiac arrest following a surgery. 1 year after that, Frank Toskin sold the remainder of the company to Estee Lauder.
We were adamant about keeping creative control. You know, Estee Lauder was a great company. We ran into a situation where we could not keep up with our demand. And we had a very large black market situation in Asia. I was sent over there to look at a MAC store, and I went there, and there was a MAC store with MAC employees and MAC product, but it was not MAC at all. And we went to the government there, and we went through some conflict, and we asked. We were told that if we didn't start using our brand within a year in that country, and we didn't start trading, that we would lose it. So we had to respond to that. We had a very short time, and we couldn't do it on our own, and we had to align ourselves with somebody that had distribution in all of those countries already. And Estee Lauder was at the top. They were a credible company who were doing many great things. And we tapped into their distribution, and within a few months, we were all over the world. And that was part of the reason we needed that relationship, and we needed that partnership. That company had grown up, it had taken on a life of its own, and it was ready to walk on its own. And I felt that, you know, I had given it as much as I could up till that point. And I felt there was a great cost to me personally. I had lost Frank at that time. And I felt that I needed to look inward and find out who I was and what things I had given up in that time that I had dedicated everything that I had to this brand. And family was very important to me. I adopted 4 children, and to get that sense of family again. And as a gay couple, that was very controversial back then. But we managed to fight through it, and we got 4 beautiful children. And so I had to do that. So I think looking inward and re-energizing myself and empowering myself again to do to take another step in a different direction. I needed that time off. It was bittersweet. There was a great feeling of loss because I had, because of how entrenched I was in that brand and how much the brand was about me and how much I had given to it. You know, there was a feeling of loss, and I had, you know, people were defining me by the brand. So, you know, to have that ripped away from you all of a sudden, it was a big loss. And there was, a moment where I felt very much like I had nothing underneath my feet. But, I tried to stay focused on the beautiful children that I now had and the opportunities that they offered me.
Entrepreneurship is notoriously addictive, and Frank Toskin is no less passionate today than he was in 1984. Perhaps not coincidentally, like Lev Glasman of Fresh and Bobby Brown of Bobby Brown Cosmetics, his new endeavor focuses on beauty from the inside out. It's called Impact Kitchen, and it's fine, fresh, fast food that follows a paleo diet. So no gluten, minimal processing. I happen to go to the location in Toronto's East End near my work share space, and I can attest to how delicious the salads and baked goods are. There are 2 other locations in Toronto, and a new location is opening in South Beach next year.
I also started a new business, which is, totally unrelated, but related in some way, because as I grew older, I realized how important health was, and most of who we are is obviously is about what we eat. So that's always been, food has always been a passion of mine, and I thought I would take a stab at creating this brand Impact. I met someone who became my trainer years ago, and we kind of collaborated on some ideas, and we developed an incredible menu. So we started this restaurant that's basically sort of follows a paleo diet. We're gluten-free, sugar-free, all of the things that tend to create havoc with our bodies. And I found that, eating well made me feel better. It gave me much more clarity. And, beauty, I did beauty from the outside. Now I kind of trying to do it from the inside. I love everything. The Harvest Bowl is great, and it's organic and it's clean. And, well, we've only started. We've only started. Yeah, it's a whole new life. You know, hey, I've got some time left. I better make good use of it. I'd love to, you know, do more education around, you know, healthy eating, because, you know, obesity has is the next crisis, and teaching young children how to eat properly, going into schools and delivering great lunches would be something that I want to work towards.
Frank and his current partner have four adopted children, twin boys aged 21, a daughter of the same age, and a younger son who's 20. We asked Frank if any of his children aspire to the business of beauty themselves.
My boys have no interest in the beauty industry at all. They're not interested at all. My daughter started with, she took a great interest. She loves makeup. She worked for MAC for a short time. She worked in the store and she worked in the office. She wears her makeup beautifully, but she's taken a little bit of a turn. And I think having gotten into this other business, Impact, and eating well, she's looking at more how she can look after herself from a wellness point of view.
Iconic beauty brands aren't built on the blood, sweat, and tears of one person alone. But don't take it from us. Wise words from the legend himself.
Build a team around you that you can count on, because it's very difficult to make it on your own. You're going to have to count on somebody at some point in time, and I think the people that you surround yourself with are going to be your power.
Thanks for tuning in. Visit BreakingBeautyPodcast.com for details on all the damn good products we talked about in today's episode.
And be sure to sign up for our newsletter. That way you'll get every episode delivered right to your inbox. You won't miss a single thing.
Or subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, Google Play, wherever you get your podcast fix.
And please show us some love by rating us or reviewing us in iTunes. See you next time.